You wait months for a guest to talk with authority about scary movies, then two come along at once. Following Jordan Peele's fine turn in our previous episode, we're delighted to welcome Eli Roth to the show this time around. Eli is a writer, director, actor and producer who came to prominence with films such as Cabin Fever and Hostel. While much of his work is not for the faint-hearted, his latest project, The House with a Clock on Its Walls, follows the great Spielberg tradition of frightening family fun. Eli is also an encyclopedia when it comes to score, to the point at which we couldn't source half the music he refers to, but no matter, as you'll hear, he delivers quite the lesson nonetheless. Before we head to Score School, a word from our good friends at beer52.com, whose offer of a free case of craft beer is still up for grabs. Beer 52 is the world's most popular monthly craft beer discovery club, searching out exclusive small batch craft beers from the world's greatest breweries and bringing them back for their members. This month, Beer 52 has enlisted some of the best craft beer brewers from the UK and across Europe to bring you the Citizens of Everywhere case. Europe's given us so much over the years, booze cruises, exotic sausages, a royal family, but perhaps its greatest gift has been beer and breweries. Now, we love drinking this stuff, and our homegrown craft brewing talent loves working alongside their European counterparts. That's why Beer 52 and Ferment have teamed up with the awesome Citizens of Everywhere project to bring you world-class collaborations, showcasing the very best of UK-EU relations. Whatever may come of Brexit, we're excited to show that the craft beer community is as excited as ever by its future of brewing and drinking beer together. Try the one-of-a-kind Citra Grisetti, which is a collaboration brew from Fine Ales from the UK and Beerbliotech from Sweden. Or why not enjoy a mango milkshake IPA by Welsh outfit Tiny Rebel, or perhaps Mount Celebre from France. There's something for everyone's taste, whether you already love craft beer or simply want to try it out for the very first time. And you can get your first case for free. Just pay £5.95 postage. That's 8 incredible craft beers, Ferment magazine, and a snack delivered with next day shipping. There's no minimum commitment. You can just take the free case, try the beers and see what you think. If it's not for you, you can pause or cancel any time. All you have to do to take advantage of this offer is head to beer52.com/sound. That's the word beer followed by the numbers 5 and 2.com/sound. And so to Eli and the House with a Clock in Its Walls, which was scored by his frequent collaborator, Nathan Barr. Now, there is a fabulous story behind Nathan's work on the film, which Eli will tell you all about in just a moment. Suffice to say, our first cue, quite different around here, is a fair reflection of the sonic tone the pair of them were aiming for. Welcome to Soundtrack, and I don't know if anyone's told you what we're going to be.
Not a word.
I mean, it kind of says in the title. It's a little giveaway, almost.
Yeah, I know. I had a hunch.
Congratulations on the House with Clocks, because I out to my 10-year-old, and we had the best time.
Oh, what did your 10-year-old think?
He absolutely loved it.
That's
he
great. Laughed. 10's the age. When I was 10, the movies that I saw in the theater were the Amblin movies.
Like, yeah.
Exactly. Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., Poltergeist, Gremlins, Goonies, but also Time Bandits was a huge one for me.
Wow.
Very big influence on me.
It's great because you want to scare them, like not terrify them.
Yeah.
But I loved being, like I loved in things like the Goonies, like the Fratelli family were utterly
very
scary.
And by the way, the first 20 minutes of E.T. is very scary. We know now E.T. is friendly, but as a kid, that was freaky. And there's a great joy in being scared, especially when you're a kid. It's so much fun. And the key is you don't want to traumatize children. You want to do something that scares them, but it's almost like a gateway movie. This is the movie, if you love scary movies, you bring your kids to, and it gets them into scary movies. And you can't start your kids out on Hostel 2 or Texas Chainsaw. You need to ease them into it. So the fun is giving them that thrill. And that was Spielberg's advice to me, was make it scary. And I remember when I went to see those early Spielberg films and the early Amblin movies, they were very, very scary. But they also had that sense of magic and wonder and adventure. And I felt like the kids' scary PG movie felt like a lost art form to me.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to make a movie like that, for like one from my childhood.
And all those films that you mentioned, music was an incredibly big part of it, and a fantastic number of composers, be it Jerry Goldsmith,
John Williams.
Yeah, Dave Grusin for Goonies as well. Just this wonderful collection, and it was such an important part of those films. You think of those films, and you also think about the music.
Yeah, you think of dun, 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 dun. You think of E.T., you think of Back to the Future, and
all that
Gremlins,
stuff.
All that. Yeah. The mischievous music in Gremlins.
So when you were thinking about the music for the house with clocks and its walls, where did you start, and how did you... You know, Nathan, you've worked with, you know,
many times
and going back to work with him, and the conversations that you had about how it would sound as a film.
Nate Barr is an amazing composer. I mean, he's so accomplished. On Cabin Fever, he probably played 40 different instruments.
Whoa.
Literally. Hostel, we had an orchestra, but Nate has, I mean, he bought a glass harmonica to record. Like, he's like, that's what I want to use. He's like, Benjamin Franklin invented this, and I bought one. It was like, what? So he's been, like, all these crazy sounds. He collects rare instruments and restores them, and he can play all of them. He's really a prodigy.
Thank you.
one of these guys, like, for a vacation, he'll go to Mackinac Island in Michigan and bring cellos when there's no cars, and he just plays, you know, string quartets, concert concertos. And this is, you know, he plays chamber music. Like, that's what he does for hobby, in addition to diving with sharks. So we really bonded over that. But we talked about the score for this, and both of us said we have to come up with a new sound. You know, Cabin Fever was a particular sound. Hostel was a particular sound. Hemlock Grove, which he's Emmy nominated for, was a particular sound. Last Exorcism. And we wanted to do something that didn't feel or sound like anything we had done before. We didn't want to imitate John Williams, but the music that I've been listening to a lot lately is Bruno Coulet. I loved his score in Coraline, and he has a number of different scores that are really, really beautiful and haunting and creepy and elegant. So I wanted something that was closer to some John Williams, but really like Danny Elfman, Bruno Coulet. That was the sound template. Said, you know, I bought the Fox Wurlitzer. And I was like, what is that? He said, well, this is the probably, he's like, for music collectors, it's the most famous organ in the world. In 1928, every silent theater, there were thousands of these organs. And they weren't just pipe organs. They had 1,140 pipes, but all these different instruments that it could play. Like, so when someone rang a doorbell, you'd push a button and it was actually a buzzer that was a musical buzzer. Wow. Or wind chimes when you'd see wind and a shh, like all these different, you know, if there was a horn that if a car went by, so it was all controlled from these different keyboards and pedals, and you're pushing buttons and live scoring, not just scoring, but doing the sound effects in a way,
it's the whole
but
sound
musically,
department.
The entire live for every showing of the movie. Then when sound came in, they were literally thrown out. They were just taken and thrown in the street and melted down for like the war. That's what happened to all of them, except maybe there's 10 left in the world. And Fox Studios took one and they had it, and it took up 7 rooms. It recorded, I think, Patton, The Sound of Music, Star Trek, The Motion Picture, like so many composers have used this organ. And 25 years ago, it was boxed up. They just packed it up because it was taking up too many buildings and no one was using it. And there's, you know, electronics. But it sounds one of a kind. So Nate had this idea 5 years ago. Not only is he going to restore this organ, he's going to build his own studio. So he takes all of his money and builds a 7,000 square foot recording studio that's his, called Bendrika. And he has the Wurlitzer there. And he built these rooms and spent 5 years restoring it. So he said, you know, Eli, I have the organ, the Fox organ. He goes, this is actually perfect because we can use it in the movie. And there's just nothing. It's like you hear this organ. It just sounds so magnificent. It's like it's from another world. It just takes you back to another time. There's kind of a timeless quality to the film that we wanted to have. I don't know if this is actually going to work on, you know, on the score, but.
Oh my God,
and yeah, the score will be out. But so you can see, like, this is the organ here, and you can see him playing. and it plays the drums. You see, those are your foot pedals that are playing the drums.
Oh my God, it's incredible. Does he do tours? I want to go and visit the organ.
Well, if you, you know, by the way, yeah, you should.
Oh, wow.
And it's blowing the wind. Yeah, I mean.
I imagine he had to learn how to use it as well. Do you know what I mean? Because there's a lot going on there.
There's so much going on. No, I mean, you have to be a music nerd to even understand how to play this
so
thing.
So many buttons and pedals.
Yeah, so there's so many buttons. Yeah, and then it's in all these different rooms, and there are different compressors. Then he takes me upstairs, and these are, that's
the
it.
The pipes.
The pipes. There's 1,140 pipes. It takes up three rooms.
I mean, that's got to be a complete bastard to mic up. It's for
well, it's, he knows how to do it. He built the studio. He spent 5 years doing this. So our movie, The House of the Clock and Its Walls.
Oh, wow.
You hear that sound? We're the first movie in 25 years that's used this. And it's never sounded quite like this. All the different... I mean, he'll show you the inner workings. These are all... See, these are all the different instruments it plays. That's the... You're inside the organ there.
It looks pristine as well.
It is.
It's been remarkably preserved.
He rebuilt... That's like if there's a fire truck or an alarm. He can play these different... Yeah, like that's all controlled by the organ, the drums. I mean, and these were all, there were thousands of these. That's what's so amazing. It's just a few pipes.
I love that,
but
he's
the sound of it is
chosen
just,
to do this.
That's, I mean, it's just school, magic. It? And look, he built this beautiful Art Deco studio. So yeah, once I heard that, I just thought, there's nothing in the world that sounds like this.
Yeah.
It's a lost sound. And we have it. So let's do the entire end credits, taking the different themes of the movie.
Yeah.
And do like a suite of all the different scores and different parts and different, you know, take people on this emotional journey. And once Nate played it for me, it was so beautiful that I then did Edward Gorey style animation for the end credits to go with the organ. It's just, and I just want people sitting in the theater just listening to this beautiful concert. It's really incredible what he did.
It's taken 5 years to do this, and films take a long time from when the first conversation starts to when we see them as film fans on the screen. But whilst you're making this film and knowing that you have this incredible thing that's going to accompany it and be part of it, did that help you in terms of a director and tone and that side of things?
Well, he told me about it, but it wasn't built yet, so I really had no comprehension of what he was talking about. I just trusted him, and I took his word for it, and I understood the references, and the organ is part of the movie. Really came to life was in the Nickelodeon scene, because you could score all of that Nickelodeon music with this organ and it felt period correct. Mm-hmm. I'm very conscious of music. I listen to a lot of soundtracks and music, and kind of while I'm directing the movie, I'm pulling out my selects for editing. So yeah. I'm listening to a lot of the Bruno Coulet music and a lot of different scores and just kind of making playlists mm-hmm. of different songs that when I start editing the movie, I know I'm going to cut this scene to that song.
Yeah.
So for example, like I used to download stuff. Now I kind of use Spotify. And this is while I'm shooting,
okay.
You know, House of the Clock. You know, I was listening to this one, the Bruno Coulet's Marie Curie score.
Oh, wow.
I just kind of love this. I love this. And I thought maybe this is him on the bus. Maybe this is this him arriving? So like when I'm driving to set, I'm kind of like, you know, I'm kind of hearing this European sound and thinking of the tone of the movie. I watched a lot of Jean-Jacques Beignet, Betty Blue.
Yeah.
I love the Gabriel Yared score for Betty Blue. So I, and then, so this kind of stuff, there, oh, there's...
I love that. The music's almost forming the pictures in your head.
Yeah.
It's
so when you're sitting there like that, for me, you know, when you find that song.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. This is Bruno Coulet from Journal d'une Femme de Chambre. Yeah. Journal of a Chambermaid. And so when I'm thinking about like him coming into New Zebedee and him on the bus and everyone's like, you're making a scary, and like this kind of, this thing feels like a kid approaching, going to a haunted house, going into the unknown, something
yeah.
strange, something might be dangerous, or he's in the house. So you just have these. And then I heard this song, like, I just started listening to They Might Be Giants for some reason.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Like, I just, for some reason, I hadn't heard them. And then I started listening to the song Istanbul. And I would play this on set, and it just kind of gets the crew going. You're like, everyone just kind of gets in a mood. And there's something about it that feels like 1940s. You know, they're just kind of feels period appropriate. And I thought maybe this would be cool for the end credits.
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, not Constantinople. So if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say. People just liked it better that way. So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone, Constantinople. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks. Istanbul.
But really, this one, yeah, this, the Marie Curie Bruno Coulet. This I kind of had on repeat. So as I'm driving to set in the morning,
yeah,
you know, you just sit and you listen to this and you just start seeing it. And you sort of know what you're doing. So I have those playlists for different scenes and it really helps. The music, I'm a very musically inclined person,
yeah,
and I'm studying classical piano and I played guitar and I listen to soundtracks. Pretty much that's what I listen to. Probably more so than contemporary music or pop music or hip-hop or rock or anything. I really just listen to soundtracks because they just take me to another place and they really let my mind wander and I see the imagery. And if you can kind of score it beforehand, you can shoot the scene and then you have something to temp it with. The great thing now is Spotify is I'll get the link of that song and send it to Nate and send it to my editor and go, cut the scene with this. And I go, Nate, what do you think of this? This to me feels like the right mood. This is the right balance.
Sometimes when we speak to composers, they have a slight bugbear sometimes where directors cut to temp music and they go, if you can give me something like this, that would be great.
Yeah, that happened to Christopher Young on Spider-Man. That was the story where Sam Raimi was temping it with Danny Elfman music and he's going to make it sound like that, make it sound like that, and to the point where Christopher Young was like, just if that's really what you want,
use it.
Use that.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's plagiarism. And I'm not really creating anything. I don't know that for a fact. That was the story I heard. So it's hard. Sometimes you find that perfect piece of score and you do fall in love with it. But for me, it's like with an actor, if I don't like what they're doing or I don't think it's right or I don't think they're there yet, I'll make them do it again. And that's my job, is to push everyone and be the annoying voice going, come on, come on, come on, come on. No, we can do it. We can do better. We can do better. It's got to be, it's not right. I don't know. Like, you know, you make that sound and people generally want to please. And if they're professional, they won't take it personal. So it's like with my cinematographer or my editor, if I think something isn't quite nailing it,
yeah,
I'll tell them. And sometimes what I usually do, to be fair, is Nate will send me the cues. I'll watch it and then I won't have any reaction. I'll let it sit for 24 hours and then listen to it again and then listen to it again. I'll listen to it about 10 times before I jump in. Sometimes you don't have that luck. You know, you just have to give notes right away. But I'll usually listen to it over and over and over so I get used to it. But if something isn't landing emotionally, I try to direct it. Instead of going, make it sound like the temp, I go, this is the moment I feel like we're missing. The scene is really building to this. But here, I feel like we're getting a little ahead of the character, but we want to feel a little bit afraid for him. And sometimes something's just like, it's not scary enough. Or sometimes I'll go, I can't even explain why, but it's not working.
Yeah.
But listen to the temp and just whatever the temp did is working. So I don't say, make it sound like that. I go, it's having a different emotional effect. And Nate and I have known each other for 15 years now, and he's very fast, and he'll just redo it.
How did you guys start working together? How was the start of that working?
We started... Nate and I started through my producer on Cabin Fever, is a woman named Lauren Mays, and she had made a movie called Briar Patch, and Nate scored it. And Nate, again, on Briar Patch, played all the instruments, had this really, really beautiful southern gothic string sound. It's kind of swamp music. It was fantastic. I loved his score. Actually, the same DP, Scott Keevan, went on to shoot Cabin Fever, so I kind of poached the Briar Patch crew. And we just really got along.
Yeah.
And now he scores The Americans, and he's doing a lot of stuff. But I feel like, it's funny because in person we joke about this, that for a long time Nate looked like he was 15 years old, like he just looks like a kid. He doesn't anymore, but so people would be like, wait, that's the composer? You know, you picture your composer looking like, I don't know, whatever you imagine a composer looks like.
Einstein
or something. Yeah. That's what they all look like, or Beethoven or something. Yeah. And then they see Nate Barr and he looks like a kid in jeans and a t-shirt, but he's this kind of this mad genius. And I'm really, really proud. You know, I'm really proud of the score that we did together. I think it's something that both of us were ready to do. I think we were both ready to prove ourselves on a bigger stage and do something that I think it's Oscar worthy. I think it's a magnificent score.
Imagine that on set, you watch this, the film, and the chemistry and the fun that Jack and Kate are having in particular is infectious to watch. I imagine that was a lot of fun to, if you had to direct it, to be honest, because it's lovely when those those things happen on screen with two people. It's just, yeah, it's great.
You just sit back. It's great, you know, as a director, to have really the two best in the business as your leads. I mean, I think that Kate is like our Meryl Streep or Judi Dench. I mean, there's only one of her in the world, and there's just no one at her level. And she can do anything. And nobody knows how funny she is. She's a freaking goofball. She's so funny. Loves horror movies. Super into Evil Dead. Like, stuff you wouldn't expect. And Jack Black. Jack's an amazing dramatic actor. You watch his performance in Richard Linklater's film Barney, and he's brilliant in that movie. And Jack, to me, is our generation's Robin Williams. He can do Dead Poets and Awakenings and Good Will Hunting, but he could also do Mrs. Doubtfire and Jumanji, and he's brilliant. And I think that Jack brings out the best comedy in Kate, and Kate brings out the best drama in Jack. And there's such love and respect between the two of them that you really just get this magic on screen. And it's nice when you have actors that are like, you don't have to shoot them separate. You just shoot them together and just watch them. It's just a pleasure to watch them. We had a great time on set. And the boy, Owen Vaccaro, is just amazing. Wow. And he brings the energy, and he is funny, and he's always laughing, and he always has a great story. I mean, just everybody, the whole Kyle MacLachlan, Renee Goldsberry, just everyone in the cast brought this fantastic, fantastic energy to set, going, let's do something special. Let's make the kind of movie like we used to see when we were kids.
Yeah, it was so easy to find him. You know, it's such an important part of the puzzle.
For me, I was, well, we had Jack and Kate, that was a big thing. And then I thought, all right, we need the house and we need the kid. Found a house and was like, thank God. And then Owen Vaccaro, first day of casting, walks in. I was like, wow, I think we're done. And I thought, was this too easy? Something went wrong. So then I'd see a bunch of other kids. And then we chemistry read Owen, just so everyone was sure. But I was like, no, day one, Owen walked in. He's probably the third person. I was like, no, it's the kid. He's funny. He's dramatically great. He's got the depth. Let's see how he pairs up with Jack. And he felt vulnerable. He had the vulnerability. I wanted to feel scared for this kid. Some kids were amazing actors. They're a little too tall. You know, they like were pubescent. So they just didn't look that threatened by being in a haunted house. Owen still has this little kid innocence of like, you can tell he's scared, misses his mom, and it's in a big spooky house. Like, you just want to give him a hug and protect him.
I think the sale of those goggles going to go through the roof.
After this
film. Leaving the cinema, and Rudy's like, where can we get those, Mom?
Really?
Where can we get them?
By the way, we tried. I was like, Lazy Boy, 8 Ball, Ovaltine, Captain Midnight goggles. Nobody wanted to make them. They're like, well, let's see what happens with the movie. Once the movie comes out, then I think you might start seeing them.
Can we talk about a couple of other composers you've worked with?
Yeah, sure.
Death Wish with Ludwig.
God, Ludwig Göransson.
Wow.
A genius, too.
Oh, my God.
I feel very lucky that I got to work with Ludwig.
Yeah.
He's amazing. He's such a cool dude. I mean, you know, he's like this 33-year-old Swedish guy. He's also producing Childish Gambino. And Ludwig also has his own studio. And he's a really, really sweet guy. And he was incredible, you know. And again, the Death Wish score, we wanted something that didn't sound like any other movies that I had done or that he had done. And he just came up, it almost sounded electronic, but it was all live. It was just the most beautiful, incredible score.
Yeah.
And we recorded it down at Sony, and it was something. Sounds and says, this is what I'm thinking. And some of it was just completely from another planet that didn't quite work. And, you know, but he's very directable and a real, real great collaborator. And I loved it. You know, we just had it. We could take the hip-hop music and blend it into the theme. And, you know, I knew what songs I was going to use for the Chicago drill sound, the sound of Death Wish, and how we were going to incorporate that and how we were going to blend from Ludwig's music.
Yeah.
And the blurring the line between score and sound design, which I love, where he starts, goes into the score, and it should feel... In Death Wish, we wanted to have what started off as a normal score, and as his mental state deteriorates, the score gets crazier and crazier. So we really... use the music to show the escalation of someone completely losing their mind, which is what happens in the film. And the kind of signature sound, we called it the Inception horn sound. When he becomes the Grim Reaper and goes out and kills. It was a pleasure. Yeah. And I love the music he's putting out. I remember before Death Wish, he went to Africa to research Black Panther and get all the sounds for that. You know, he takes it very, very seriously.
Yeah, we spoke to Ryan on the show, and he went into great detail about the research that he did.
No, he's a real deal, Ludwig. I feel very lucky that I've got to work with two very gifted composers. And Manu Rivero, who did Green Inferno and Knock Knock, I thought did incredible scores. He just like sits in the forest in Spain at a piano and just does this incredible music. And Green Inferno, we recorded that with an orchestra in Bratislava. Green Inferno was this big jungle tribal sound. Drums and all of that, which is very, very influenced by a composer named Roberto Donati,
yeah,
who did the music for Umberto Lenzi for Cannibal Ferox and other films. I was actually just with Fabio Ferrizzi. Lucio Fulci's composer. I was literally just texting him now. He's like, are you coming to Italy with the movie? And he came over to my house 2 weeks ago. It was a pleasure to finally meet him because I have so many of his scores from the Lucio Fulci movies. But, you know, I really wanted a sound for Green Inferno that felt like a Fabio Ferrizzi, really like Fabio Ferrizzi's Zombie 2 score and Roberto Donati's Cannibal Ferox. In the boat to set. It was a 5 hours of travel every day to get to and from the set. And we would get on these canoes, go up this river. And we were really in the Amazon, farther than anyone had taken a film crew before. So we all had our music. And I was listening to the Roberto Donati's Cannibal Ferox score. just kind of visualizing the movie, because, you know, you have to, like, get up at 5 in the morning and in the vans and getting in the river and getting in the boats. And it was an adventure making that film. And then on Knock Knock, I wanted to make a much more contained, spare, a much quiet. It's like a chamber piece almost like a play. It's like a chess match with these three characters in this house, you know, after being in the jungle with hundreds of extras. And it's like, let's just see the challenge, one drop of blood, three characters in a house, and building the tension. And I really, really was into David Shire's score for The Conversation. And I love that. That beautiful, beautiful piano. And so that's what I said to Mano. I was like, I want a score that feels like the David Shire. And it's let's not do a lot of instruments. Let's not record it with an orchestra. Let's keep it to just a few instruments, because there's just only a couple of characters. It doesn't feel right to have a huge orchestral score for this movie. And I think he did a magnificent, beautiful, elegant score. Both the scores that Manu did, I think he's a very kind of underrated composer. What he did for Green Inferno and Knock Knock were magnificent.
Where did the relationship with scores start for you in terms of when you started creating films? Has it always been there? Has it always been something you've listened to?
I was always into the music. I mean, I collected soundtracks for a long time. I mean, I it started with Star Wars when you're a kid, but I remember when I was, probably 16 or 17 years old, VCRs came out with cable, and I was able to run a cable box into the VCR and then take RCA wires and take the VCR into a boom box, and I could audio record sound without putting a microphone up to the television. I could have perfect audio from a movie, so I would audio tape movies. Now, it was Caddyshack, Hamburger the Motion Picture, Glengarry Glen Ross, it would be anything.
Yellow
but
Submarine,
we would,
I believe,
Blues Brothers, we would sit and play driving to school and going on long car trips. I would play movies, and that was a lot of the way, like movies like Zapped or some 80s cable movie where you couldn't find the music. A lot of it, now people like kind of rip it and put it on YouTube, but that was how I listened to music, is I would learn the movies by heart just from listening to them over and over. So my relationship with when I started writing movies, I have playlists of writing music, but when I'm really writing a movie, I have to put on a score of a movie that's in the mood of what I'm writing. And that, like, if I'm writing something like I'm writing a cop movie, it's nowhere near complete. It's in stages and pieces.
Wow.
But I want it to be like an Italian poliziotta, so I listen to Stelvio Cipriani's music or Maurizio and Guido De Angelis. And if I'm writing a giallo film, I listen to I love Stelvio Cipriani's music and his score for Nightmare City. There's a lot of those old giallo films. Morricone music. Those are my favorite. De Angelis Brothers, Morricone, Cipriani. Those are, that's the stuff that, like, that's my jam. And then also, I've been listening to a lot of Niko Fidenko scores. He did a lot of the Commedia Sexuale Italiana movies, a lot of Joe D'Amato movies. There's a movie called Orgasmo Nero 2. Like, even these trashy movies, there's some amazing scores. Yeah. Like, there's a French cannibal film. It's one of the worst movies ever made, called Cannibal Terror. The score is so damn good to that movie. You know, like Sergio Martino's Island of the Fishmen. It's like, it's amazing. The score is incredible. Love Luigi Cozzi's film Star Crash with John Barry's score that he then recycled for Out of Africa 6 years later and won the Oscar for it. It's interesting to think about those composers and how quickly they turned over those scores, and to see, you know, where that music turned up again in different spots in their career. Like, I found a movie, I want to say I say it's not Bloody Birthday. It's called, I mean, I think it's The Initiation. The Initiation is filmed in the late 80s where a girl is going to do some college sorority thing, but she's also her twin sister who escaped the mental asylum.
Okay.
And the whole ending theme was the love theme from Cinema Paradiso.
But, no.
But Morricone didn't score The Initiation. I was like, it's like, dun. It was like, nah, nah, nah. It was like, it was amazing. It's like, I was like, wait a minute, why are we in Cinema Paradiso all of a sudden? So, I don't know if Morricone saw that movie, if that theme was there, or if it's just coincidence, but it's like, it's pretty uncanny. So, I love when you find these gems of these movies.
Hidden.
And there's some weird theme in there, and it's just come out later in some other director's or composer's masterpiece. Like making those connections. I like being a detective of those things.
Yeah.
So listening to old scores is a real hobby of mine, a real passion of mine. I've been looking for a Rogier von Otterloo score for Turkish Delights, the old Verhoeven movie. Like, there's a lot of these films that I'm just dying to find that music. And I put David Hess's music from Last House on the Left in Cabin Fever and the Sorcery music from their film Stunt Rock, the Brian Trenchard Smith. I put that in Grindhouse. I use John Harrison's Creepshow score in my section of Thanksgiving for Grindhouse, and then I use Sorcery again in Knock Knock. So there's just some go-to scores that I love, and I kind of have a list of kind of movie songs. I don't know where they're going to go, but I was like, oh man, this is an amazing piece of music. Like, I'd love to use Morricone's Exorcist II theme in a movie somewhere. It's so nuts. It's all in the trailer. Yeah, the cop film is where I would use it. It's just so good.
Eli, I feel like I really want to come and like probably go through your record collection, because your knowledge and your passion for scores and soundtracks is infectious. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. I didn't even get to talk about Francesco DeMasi's New York Ripper theme, which is one of my favorite scores. But yeah, we could go on and on. It was
Student
a pleasure for me. I'm looking forward to it. Let's do it.
Thanks, Eli.
Cheers.
Tony score to Exorcist 2, that's Magic and Ecstasy, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with director Eli Roth. My huge thanks to Eli for taking the time to talk to us. His knowledge and love of score is quite staggering. The House with a Clock in Its Walls is on home entertainment formats now, with Nathan Barr's Wurlitzer-inspired score available via our very good friends at Backlot Music. Head to edithbowman.com or iTunes to catch up on all of our previous episodes, and please do subscribe while you're there. And you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We're at Soundtracking UK for all the latest goings on. Next up, it's another Soundtracking Live as we bring you my recent conversation with Andy Serkis and Nitin Soni from the British Film Institute in London. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.